Thank you, everyone. Thank you for the introduction, Liam. Look, the topic tonight, this morning, can the working class still make a revolution? Getting ahead of myself. This is a fundamental question for Marxists, and indeed for the whole working class movement. The Communist Manifesto, some of you may have read, concludes, let the ruling class tremble at a communist revolution. The proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains. They have a world to win. Workers of the world, unite. And that clarion call has resounded through the labour movement for the last 175 years since the Communist Manifesto was written. It was the idea that launched the modern socialist movement and has sustained it for all that time. But almost as soon as the ink was dry on a Communist Manifesto, the idea was attacked. A couple of arguments have been fairly consistent since that time, particularly in the 20th and 21st centuries. The first one is the argument that it's all old hat. What Marx and Engels wrote in 1848 might well have been all very well and good for that time, but since that time, the conditions of the working class have improved dramatically. Living standards are written, children aren't being sent down to mines or up chimneys to sweep them, conditions at work are better, and this therefore has changed the workers' outlook. We're all middle class now, the slogan goes. As a result, people say that workers have been bought off, they've been incorporated into the system, they're no longer disruptive elements in capital, and therefore they'll never make a revolution. People are too disengaged, too apathetic, so goes the argument. The other argument comes from a slightly different direction, but comes to the same conclusion, which is the workers will never make a revolution. And that's because the capitalism has changed, they all agree, but capitalism has changed in a way that makes it incredibly difficult for workers to organize. The stereotype that they conjure up is that Marxists writing the time of industrial Manchester with the textile mills and later on with the big steel plants in places like Sheffield and Berlin and all the rest of them. But all those plants have now closed down. Everyone is apparently now working in small workplaces. People aren't working down the coal mines anymore and steel plants. They're all baristas or working in architects' offices. Or perhaps they're here on short-term visas, so they're impossible to organize. A whole range of arguments. So everyone's working on short-term jobs. This might resonate with a lot of you working in casual work while at uni, perhaps. And the kind of argument is extended. This is essentially a lot of the working class today. So in other words, rather than workers being too affluent to make a revolution and too bought off, the argument is they're too powerless, too weak, too disorganized, and can't be gathered together in big trade unions to fight. After all, if they fight, so the argument goes, the boss can just shut down the workplace and move to China. So that's the kind of argument that's being used. So this argument is carried by both right-wing people and also people on the left and liberal circles. It's obvious why right-wing people would argue the working class can't fight, because after all, their system depends on workers not fighting. And the more they can convince workers and supporters of the working class that their cause is irredeemably doomed, so much the better for them. Much better have a quiescent working class. And so the argument the working class are kind of unorganizable or turn to be they're too affluent, too bought off, too incorporated, they've all got, you know, amazing things like color televisions and cars now, means that essentially, you know, revolution is completely impossible, utopian, unfeasible, and probably dangerous to boot. But the more damaging argument, if you like, comes from people who identify at some level with kind of left causes and liberal causes. And they too also dispute what Marx and Engels write. Rather than using the argument explicitly to justify capitalism as a great system, they simply say that, well, unfortunately, you know, it'd be really good if workers could make a revolution. Maybe they might say that, or workers do need to improve their lot, but really times have changed. Now, I've just given a few examples here. The first one is Edward Bernstein, who is the first, if you like, exponent, you know, theoretically of a whole reformist project, sort of saying that revolution isn't on the cards anymore, capitalism can correct its crises, the working class can find a place in the system, and the only kind of socialism we might get is little by little through gradual parliamentary reform. Then you move forward 80 years to the work by a guy called André Gorz, a French sociologist, famous in fact for predicting there would never be a mass revolt in France about 3 months before a mass revolt in France occurred, 1968. But he also went into, if you like, infamy in 1980, writing his book Farewell to the Working Class, which kind of tells you everything. These poor, despondent, old, white, male workers obviously passing into history now, and we have to look to new other social classes or the middle class or professionals or maybe the unemployed or whoever. And that then is actually a theme of The Precariat by Guy Standing, which was a hot book in 2011, just 12 years ago. Guy Standing used to work for the International Labour Organization. He had quite a hit with this book, sold lots of copies. He was in conferences everywhere. And his argument was a bit like the latter category of arguments, which is the working class is so broken up now, so precarious. Everyone's in short-term temporary Mac jobs that, you know, basically the dangerous classes is no longer these people, the dangerous classes. They might, you know, they might erupt in any kinds of struggles. We just don't know. But there's nothing like the old proletariat. The proletariat is, if anything, probably a bit bought off. And therefore there can't be a workers' revolution. So what we see is arguments then coming from both the left and the right. And is therefore it's important to challenge them. So I'm just going to start off by explaining what Marxists mean by the working class. Because once you understand that, a lot of everything else falls into place. So what we mean by the working class, we don't necessarily mean, although they are a category of it, men in overalls working in factories, the category of working class is actually much broader than that. Workers mean, according to Marx and Engels, those who labour for a living for another, who do so because they do not own or control the means of production, the factories, the offices, the warehouses, trucks, raw materials, computers, machinery, and so forth, and must therefore, because they do not own these things, must sell their labour to another person. Their choice is simple, work or starve. So that is the essential characteristic then of the working class. Robbed of the means of sustaining their livelihood, they have to sell their services, their labour power, to a boss. The boss owns or controls the means of production, they can therefore hire them, and very importantly, they can exploit them. What do we mean by that? The common sense idea of exploitation is that, you know, 12-year-old children being sent down to mines, or maybe, you know, workers in a 7-Eleven being paid $5 an hour. That they are exploited, definitely, but exploitation is a much wider category than that. Workers are exploited because they are hired only to the extent they create a surplus profit, in common parlance, for the boss. If you don't make a profit for the boss, you're laid off. Everyone with any knowledge about the ups and turns of business cycles knows that. When the boss is making losses, they lay off slabs of workers. When the boss is making lots of profits, they maybe hire workers. Exploitation does not just mean cruel, savage degradation of the working class, although it often does. It means the workers produce more value than what they are paid. That's a very kind of common sense bourgeois way of explaining what Marxists would say, the value of their labour power. Okay, so what it means is, I might have a diagram here, no? Is that, let's say you have an 8-hour working day, workers work for the first four hours of that, and they produce in that time a certain amount of value, which is enough to essentially pay for their wage. The remaining 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th hour of work, essentially every hour of work above the 4 hours, they're working for the boss, because everything above and beyond that, the boss appropriates in the form of surplus labor, that eventually through a series of processes become profit in their bank accounts. That's what we mean by exploitation then. So that's the first step to understand. Okay, so the class struggle, working class, does not require that workers be paid $5 an hour. There are plenty of workers. In fact, you think about iron ore workers in Western Australia who can be paid $150,000 a year, $200,000 a year. They're still working class. Okay, so what's so special about the working class? It's important to understand this because one of the things that I mean, Marx and Engels weren't the first people to talk about the working class. So plenty of people at the time of the Industrial Revolution who looked at a lot of the working class and were tremendously sorry for them. They saw the exploitation, the cruelty, the way in which the bosses got fat off their labour, and they basically felt very sympathetic to the workers. But there's more to it from the point of Marx and Engels, because their key contribution is to explain why it was. The workers were not just exploited, but had power. And in fact, exploitation and power are two sides of the same coin. Because the extent the workers are exploited, that is also what gives them their power. The extent the workers are the only thing in capitalist production that adds value to the process of production is what gives them the power to screw the boss. Because as soon as they stop working, they stop the flow of profits. The bosses of the world, they sit in their air-conditioned offices. They don't, you know, they don't produce anything. You see every time the workers go on strike. The newspapers proclaim, you know, $5 billion in lost production due to X strike. Well, why is $5 billion in loss? Don't the bosses create lots of money? Well, it turns out they don't. Because the reason why there's $5 billion in lost production is because the workers have stopped work, very clearly demonstrating who produces value in our society. And therefore, that ability to stop production is actually a tremendous power because it really hurts the bosses. Something else, two other characteristics about the working class under capitalism. The first is that the working class is a product of urban industrialization. I mean, there were obviously rural laborers before that for several centuries. But in terms of the emergence of a mass working class working for a wage and nothing else, robbed of the means of production, we're really talking about, let's say, the 1700s, who would begin to emerge in full force. And in some countries, not until the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So it takes a whole period of some centuries for this working class to emerge all over the world. But the important thing is that whereas the laborers in the old times were working in things like fields, they're now working in big factories, in big cities. I just read a fact yesterday, in fact. In 1900, there were just 13 cities around the world, places like London, Manchester, Berlin, and so forth, had a population of more than 1 million. The figure today is 548. 548 cities around the world with a population of more than 1 million. And most of those are working class. So you can see the fact that the workers are drawn together as a collective. The common experience of work, the common experience of living in a big city, the common experience of being exploited actually gives the workers a sense of their solidity as a class and an awareness of that power. There's another aspect too, which is that workers are a cooperative class. If you think about the old times with a peasantry working in the field, their main ambition in life was to own their own plot of land, to buy off their neighbor's plot of land or to steal it, and, you know, be master of their own little kind of patch of the earth. Whereas the workers are forced by capitalism to work in a collective division of labor. That is, everyone does a small piece of the production process. With the car workers working in the car factory, one person putting on the wheels, one person putting on the bonnet, that sort of thing, means they have a collective identity because they can't just take home a bit of a field themselves. To emancipate themselves, they have to come together collectively to organize production collectively. And that's a very important characteristic. So they have to therefore cooperate. And that actually tells you how they begin to organize and eventually take power and what the kind of society the workers are capable of creating. So moving on to then working class power. So the fact that workers are collectively organized, the fact that a cooperative class with so much power brought into being by capitalism is not just a negative power, which is what I've talked about so far, the power to stop production. It's also a positive power, the power to start it up again, but under workers' control. Because when workers stop work, very obviously, you know, if strike goes on for any length of time, a few days or weeks or whatever, it becomes clear you've got to start organizing stuff. Whether or not it's just the basics of organizing a picket line. And then if you're occupying a workplace, as many workers do when they're in struggle, you have to think about how the factory is going to be protected from police attack. You have to think about how you're going to feed workers. If the workers begin to run production of their own control, they have to start thinking about where they're going to get raw materials and components. You can't just do that within the bounds of one workplace, one hospital, one factory. You've got to reach out to other people to supply you with these goods, to be an outlet for the goods you're producing, but to organize things around you. The cops are much more interested in attacking strikers. They are looking after public order. So you have to make sure you've got people ensuring security. You've got to make sure people are cared for through things like first aid and so forth. And you begin to see workers begin to organize the everyday of living. And then, therefore, they have to start beginning to organize collective committees across workplaces, then ultimately across a city, and then finally across a whole series of cities, organizing a distribution of food, organizing healthcare, organizing public transport. And once they start doing that, that begins to be the form of workers' councils. There's a picture here of Petrograd in 1917, a big meeting of a factory council of workers, arguing out what to do next. So these councils then are not an invention of Marxists. That no one read a book and said you must form a workers' council. They emerged for the most part organically out of workers' struggle by the necessity to organize collectively against the attacks by the capitalist class, by the media, by the police, by the army, and all the other instruments the capitalists have at their disposal to crush the workers. Okay, so our right wingers, perhaps, and our left wingers all sort of say, or liberals say, well, that's all very well and good. Absolutely true for Marx in 1890 or, 1883 or whatever. But actually, a lot has changed today. So let's have a look what the facts are. The first question then is, well, how has the workforce changed? The stereotype is everyone was working in a factory or on the waterfront 50 or 100 years ago, and they're now all working in offices. So there's an element of truth. These are the figures for Australia. You'll see then, perhaps you can see, that the manufacturing, that's the pink line, peaked in the 1970s, is about 25% of the workforce, is now about 8% of the workforce. Mining, peaked, that's the rough bottom, it was never much more than nearly 10%, is now about 1.5% of the workforce. Construction is slightly different. Actually, Australia has a very large construction workforce and has always had so. But what you can see, the big growth area is services. So the argument is, oh, services, that's just people working in small shops or working in small offices or some, you know, management consultants or whatever it might be. And so really, that's how the working class has been broken up. So I should say, first of all, of course, this is not a new development. Manufacturing has been declined since the mid-1970s. Mining has been declined really for 100 years, as a proportion of the workforce, that is, not as a contribution to national output. The other argument that, well, workers have it so much better off than they used to. There's no denying the fact that workers, by and large, I mean, leaving aside a very important question for now about buying your own home, which has obviously become more untenable for a lot of workers, but incomes over the broad sweep of things, living standards for the broad sweep of things, have obviously improved since Marx's day. Working hours have shrunk, paid holidays have come in, and a range of things like that. So we do see then, obviously, workers are better off. We also find out that in Australia, when people are asked, what class would you describe yourself as? About 50% of the Australian population describe themselves as middle class. They'd have about 35 or 39% call themselves working class. That sort of seems, well, maybe we are all middle class now, perhaps. But the important thing about Marxism is that what people describe themselves as has no necessary bearing on what they actually are. Because working class, remember, is an objective category. The people who are exploited at work is not to do with what you feel yourself to be. And we should also say at this point, the fact that living standards has risen is not just a miracle of capitalism, but because workers have over decades and centuries fought for them. So the fact that living standards, things like paid annual leave, things like sick pay, are a result of workers fighting for them. So in fact, the living standards are rising is actually a confirmation of one of the basic points of Marxism. The most important thing is that exploitation still defines a lot of the working class. The vast majority of workers, whether they work in blue or white collar jobs, still create value or contribute to the creation of value or its realization somewhere down the line. And as a result of which, the bosses are always trying to get more out of them. So that diagram may be a bit complicated. It basically shows you a range of blue, if like blue and white collar industries, and says, what is the rate of exploitation in those different industries? This is Australian data. Down the bottom here, total selected industries, 101%. Broadly, what that means is, that exactly fits my example earlier, actually, in an 8-hour working day, it means the workers work for 4 hours for their own wage and 4 hours for the boss. So it's 4/4, 100%. If you're in, perhaps in real estate, that's kind of weird category there. But if you're in information, there we go, a white collar sector, information, media and telecoms, the rate of exploitation is 114%. I can't do the maths off the top of my head, but it kind of means 8 hour a day, you're probably working for like 3.5 hours to yourself and 4.5 hours to the boss. So exploitation is still the lot of the working class. And that is the most fundamental fact. We can see also confirmation of Marxism. The wealth is concentrated in few hands. Officially, 60% of the Australian population own only, 16% of wealth. Now that, you would say, it kind of implies that maybe the top 5% have perhaps 20% of wealth. Actually, this is kind of all the ways in which wealth is gathered in things like surveys. If you actually looked at the amount of wealth in the hands of workers, in the bosses, in their secret bank accounts, in their huge repositories of wealth in their workplaces and whatever, you'll find actually the top 1% probably owns about 90 or 95% of all wealth in Australia and the United States and so forth. So class is still very much a distinctive feature of life in Australia and the West and the world, I'm going to argue. The next thing to say is that we talk about the rise of white-collar workers, and clearly there are more office workers than there used to be, people working not metal bashing or down the mines. That's true. But to the extent they ever saw themselves as being a cut above the blue-collar workers, you know, not quite part of that kind of grubby labour movement, and there was an element of that for sure, let's say, between the wars and beforehand. But the conditions of a lot of white-collar workers, to the degree that population has expanded, is also deteriorating relative to a lot of blue-collar workers. A lot of the things that bosses pioneered in working in factories and warehouses and so forth, they're now using on white-collar workers. Things like microelectronic surveillance, the way in which call centre operators are monitored, time and motion studies, all the rest of it. the Hollywood strike, the use of artificial intelligence to replace writers, the kind of, if you like, the modern mechanization, automation, computerization that's done away with so many jobs in blue-collar industries is also now threatening large swathes of white-collar work as well. So this is actually having an impact on white-collar workers' consciousness, and you can see that from the simple fact that the biggest unions in most Western countries, at least today, are now teachers' unions, public sector health, and public government workers. They've seen the need to unionize and organize. And to the extent they had professional staff associations 50 or 70 years ago, those professional staff associations are much more inclined to be taking industrial action now than they once would have done. So that reflects their concentration in big workplaces and their general kind of pressure, relentless pressure on white collar, except the nurses, the white collar workers or service sector workers. And when people sometimes talk about the rise of service sector workers, I'm kind of caricaturing about sort of talking about workers in coal mines versus workers in offices. There's a whole range of things that actually call white collar work or service work actually involve quite a degree of manual labor. So the distinction is by no means as clear as people would say. Things like catering, security work, cleaning, working in hotels, cleaning, changing beds, hospital work, maintenance workers in office buildings, and all the rest of it. So actually, we need to think about the working class being very diverse and in no way simply separable between kind of white collar, well off, privileged, salaried, blue collar, you know, low pay, whatever. In fact, a lot of white collar and service sector workers are paid worse than a lot of blue collar workers now, partly because of the legacy of unionization in the blue collar sectors. So the working class is a very diverse class, whether working in large or small workplaces. I put together a bit of alliteration here, manufacturing, mining, mind enriching or manicuring, all sections of the working class, whether native born or immigrants. 2/3, in fact, of the population, when you break down all these occupations bit by bit, you do like kind of census survey and you find out about 65% of the Australian population, Australian workforce, are in working class jobs. And then you add to that their dependents, their children, the aged people, you add the unemployed, the women working in home and so forth, and you obviously have a very substantial portion of the Australian population. Out of a population of maybe 25 million, you're probably talking about a working class, I don't know, about 17 million or 18 million or something. So a substantial portion of it. And you look at Australia, I mean, it's a cut and dried. Like, we do not have a big farming population. We do not have a lot of, in America, they call them disparaging kind of flyover cities. We have, basically everyone lives in six cities, pretty much. So we have a big concentration. The experience of a worker in Sydney is much the same as the experience of a worker in Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, or whatever. And that is actually the lot of 80% of the Australian population. And then if you extend our horizons to look globally, of course, Marx and Engels are saying workers of all lands unite. They look very globally, even in 1848, even when the working class was tiny. The industrial working class was limited in their day to basically Belgium, England, bits of Paris, and one of maybe bits of New York and Boston, perhaps. Now, of course, the working class is spread all over the world. You look at India and China in the last 30 years, the movement of hundreds of millions of peasants into the cities to get work of various kinds, or the call centers. This is textile and clothing factories. Now wage workers, just like their brothers and sisters in the West have been. In fact, just in the recent years, for the first time, the majority of the world's population now live in cities rather than live in the countryside. So we contrast that with Marx's day when he just had little kind of red dots around kind of the east coast of the United States and in northwest Europe. Now the working class is a global class. The working class straddles the world. So what about this argument about are the workers too powerless to change the world? So that kind of presumes the idea that workers are now working in kind of small cafeterias or whatever. But actually, the critical nodes of production might have shifted, but they're still very much material circulations of capital, resources, labor power, and so forth. I mean, the obvious ones are things like Amazon, warehouses, logistics operations, trucking, railways, shipping, aviation, the movement of goods, how it is you can put an order on Amazon today and get it delivered tomorrow. All the things that go together to making that happen are actually an example of the kind of interlinkages between different sections of capitalism. And so the connections, and this also gives workers in those areas tremendous power. Because when they stop in one place, it immediately has knock-on effects to the whole system. So if you think about as component workers in Mexico, also component workers in Mexico a few years ago went on strike, and within about 3 days, General Motors factories across the United States closed down because without the components, they couldn't make the cars. And even when you think about the waterfront, everyone says, oh, well, the waterfront in Australia, so all these thousands of workers, and they're so powerful then, and look at it all today, it's all just robots and cranes and whatever. Actually, there was that very smallness of number actually gives them tremendous power. You need to organize fewer workers to make something happen. There was an example in the ABC News last weekend, actually, in Darwin. 11 workers in a company were going on strike as part of the enterprise bargaining campaign, and the Northern Territory News reported that it was likely that fuel was likely to be cut off at service stations all over the territory. So you see, that's just 11 workers can do that. So just because automation happens doesn't rob workers of their power. And you can also think of other examples too. You can think about examples of call center workers and IT workers. Think about IT workers. How is a big company going to work if the IT sector goes down? The movement of finance puts workers and banks in the financial sector in a critical position. Even teachers who don't directly control the flow of profits can have a tremendous impact on the creation of profit elsewhere by the fact that workers then have to stay at home to look after their children. So that helps to crunch the capitalist system. And you only need to think about the pandemic to find out all these workers, regardless kind of peripheral and kind of no one really even thinks of these people, all of a sudden the cleaners and the drivers and whatever, the warehouse workers, were now essential workers. Because it was realized, I mean, everyone, you know, people who knew, but people who'd been pretending they weren't important now found they were important. They were so important, in fact, they had to go to work even during a pandemic. And also, I'd make one small point, that the kind of electronic surveillance that's happening, the kind of use of IT and social media to monitor workers, can also be used by the workers themselves to organize. A few years ago, I was interviewing a Chinese leftist of some description who was organizing in, what was he doing? Food delivery. Food delivery is an enormous industry in China, with the cities all dispersed all over the country, and they're able to organize a strike by using the, might have been WeChat or QQ perhaps, social media to organize delivery drivers to all stop on the same day. Casualization, things like short-term workers, people on visas, are they too powerless to change things? I'd only point out the fact there's a certain maybe obsession with the number of workers on temporary and casual jobs. There's no doubting, obviously, that a lot of this exists, particularly for young people. But when you look at the majority of the working class, they're not all in kind of here today, gone tomorrow jobs. Most people in jobs are pretty much full-time, pretty much permanent. Most workers, in fact, have been in their jobs for 7 years on average. In fact, the average length of time workers stay with their boss is actually getting longer. So the average situation in the working class is they're not all being thrust into short-term jobs where they're all on kind of contract and moving to, you know, one workplace one day, another workplace another day. You can't get them into union because they're always turning over. In fact, there's every opportunity for workers to get organized and fight. Look at the visa workers. There was a good example of food processing workers down in Victoria recently. They went on strike. They were on strike for 24 hours, and they won their demands in 24 hours. So visa workers can strike too. And you would actually also have to say that kind of one of the, not so much the quirks of history, but one of the telling points of history is, in fact, the very workers who are regarded as being most vulnerable, most precarious, most on the edges of things, are sometimes the first workers to move. Because their very precariousness, their very sense of their lives on the edges actually makes them more likely to fight because they don't have the luxury of feeling comfortable the boss is going to look after them because they know that's not going to happen. The workers who are on permanency and so forth can actually be sometimes the last to move because they feel like their situation's okay. So in both ways, we shouldn't exaggerate the degree to which the working class has all been broken up into short-term, kind of casual, short, 2-day jobs, nor must we actually write off their potential to the extent that workers are in those sort of situations. When it comes to it, the bosses need the workers. Sorry about this, I'm slightly overrunning. Okay, apathy. What about apathy? If you look at the figures, you can actually be excused for thinking that's a realistic thing to say. You look about working class struggle, any sociologist at the University of Queensland or whatever can tell you, working class struggle. Look at the figures. That's how workers are struggling. This is strike days. Okay, so it shows you between 1940 and 2014, the figures shoot up in the first half and they go down all the way in the second half. And today, the number of strikes in Australia is pitiful. But I would argue that does not mean affluence. That is not the result of affluence or anything. The working class has been in retreat, but it doesn't mean then that they are comfortable or anything with the situation. What we find today, in fact, actually, in the last year, has been proved so obviously that the bosses in Australia, Europe, United States, China, whatever, Japan, are on the attack. A common experience now is that for the first time in the last probably 80 or 90 years, or maybe even 100 years, workers today, if they have kids, believe their kids will be worse off than they are. They think their workers will have a rougher life. And that is a very unusual situation in terms of the development of capitalism. And there's actually obviously fuel for workers to get angry about the system. They can get angry about the fact their wages are being cut. This is a change in real wages across a whole series of OECD countries. And this is the profits in Australia, and that's how much wages have been going on. So we've seen an enormous push by the capitalist class to screw the workers. And not just with wages, you look at house prices and the rentals going up through the roof, and then you look at existential crises like war and climate change. You can't just tinker with those things. If World War III breaks out, this isn't a matter of passing legislation in Parliament. It means a mass struggle for the very humanity's existence, as, of course, does the whole prospect of global warming and climate change, as we've seen. I was just driving this morning, 80 people died in Hawaii in a fire. This stuff is going to be happening like every week. The important thing is that when workers fight, they do an enormous amount, not just for themselves, but also for the rest of the working class. So one of the things we see, there was a discussion yesterday about why don't we talk about compassionate empathy? And why don't we think about how individuals think about things? Well, I have to say, when the working class begins to fight, it has a tremendously uplifting impact on the whole working class. Obviously, people, they know about it, but just generally, the sense goes on, workers just go to work, they're charging to work day after day, day after day, don't think much about anything else going on. Then all of a sudden, they find out, this is stopping, that's stopping. They work near their brother-in-law, their sister, their uncle, whatever it might be. Something you heard down the pub, something's reported on the radio. The workers begin to move, and that starts to lift the spirits of the working class. It's when things like the old slogan, an injury to one is an injury to all, become alive, which is so precious to working class resistance and advance. Compared to that, the bosses, of course, are always trying to sow division. They're always trying to sow rivalry, always trying to show bitterness and envy and jealousy and hatred between different sections of the working class. They do that, of course, because they want to keep workers divided. So what happens there is two things. First of all, the struggle helps to unite, but a struggle in and of itself is not enough. We also have to accept the fact there'll be people trying to short circuit that struggle, just to direct it into some kind of government committee or some kind of restructuring review or whatever. Actually, then we have the political fight within the working class about whether or not the movement is going to go forward. So fundamentally, the argument is actually a very political argument. It may sort of start with kind of dry statistics about the size of the workforce in manufacturing. But really what we're talking about is an argument being pushed by, obviously by right-wingers, but also those within the labor movement and around its ranks in the intellectual and media circles who actually don't really have an interest in working class making a revolution, want to make sure they don't have one. And that is, in the short term, is often the argument used by the trade union leaders. Many is the time they say, why won't the workers fight? Why are the workers so backward? Why do we call a strike? No one comes out or whatever. But the problem is they don't really organize. They don't really call strikes. They don't really fight seriously. And so they use, to the extent they ever do these things and maybe don't get a good response, they say, oh, the workers are so backward. They're so whatever. This is total bullshit. They never fight seriously. They never want to give the workers a head. And when the workers do go on strike, they can't wait to get them back to work again. And so this is just three headlines I picked out of recent issues in Red Flag. Wage crisis. Where are the unions? What are they doing? A dismal job site. He's Sally McManus with Michelle O'Neill and the boss of the Business Council of Australia, all chatting together about the onset of the COVID pandemic. This is Alma Tolikovic, a comrade of Sydney University, saying, why are the Sydney University workers union leadership actually needing a proper fight for an enterprise agreement actually lifts wages rather than cutting them? So this argument is not just some dry academic argument about statistics and census data. It's an argument essentially within the working class movement, within the labor movement, between those who want to hold back the working class and those who want to advance it. Those who basically see the projects being no more than how can we make Australia more nationally competitive? How can we maybe lift living standards just a touch? But how can we do anything without disturbing the status quo in any serious way? And those who actually want to take the working class forward. And that actually comes down to the fight for revolutionary politics within the workers' movement, because only revolutionaries are the people who really want to fight to the bitter end and really fuck over the capitalists to advance the cause of the working class. So a couple of things just to conclude, Dan. So to summarise my argument, The workers are still the force to be reckoned with. The very fact of exploitation gives them power. The obituary for the working class has been written, as I said, ever since the Communist Manifesto written, and yet the working class keeps coming back to discredit that argument. This is not because workers are superior class, or they think better things, or they're more inclined to like other people. It's because capitalism forces them to fight. The very condition of capitalism is the bosses are always screwing over the working class, and the working class either submit to it and get pushed backwards, or they rally and fight and get their fellow brother workers and brother and sister workers to fight with them to push back against the bosses. And that's the situation when you see the apparent apathy of the working class move over into revolt. And then we lift our horizons globally again. We can actually see the last 20 or 30 years around the world have actually been characterized, maybe not so much in Australia, maybe not in the United States, but in many, many countries around the world, by mass movements that overthrow governments or presidents or dictatorships in which the working class has played an important part. I'm not going to list them all. I've run out of time. But all over the globe, you'll find that mass revolts have broken out precisely because capitalism delivers, you know, no democracy. Invariably, you'll find these fights of democracy associated with things like fuel prices going up, jobs being slashed, pension ages being lifted, economic attacks on the working class, political repression. Workers have to fight for their rights. Now, most of them have been beaten back. That is an unfortunate story of the workers' struggle of the last 150 years. Most of them lose. But the crucial thing is to gather from those struggles the kind of people who are willing to learn and be educated and teach others about that experience and the need to go further than they did last time. And that actually requires revolutionary organization to bring those workers together, to organize in that way and to teach others. And I'll finish finally with one of the great poems of the last There we go. Percy Shelley. Rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, watching sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few. They need us, we don't need them.